you for joining me. I am Nick Kramer, and this is the Fisheries Podcast, a weekly podcast that shares the stories of the amazing people and projects that make up fisheries science. If you haven't already, follow the podcast on Twitter at Fisheries Pod, on Facebook at facebook.com/fisheriespodcast, or support the podcast on patreon.com/fisheriespodcast. Our guest today is Lauren Flynn. Lauren grew up frequently moving as part of a Navy family, but strongly identifies as a Pacific Northwesterner. She holds a bachelor's in biology from Whitman College, where she also competed as a collegiate swimmer. She then went on to work in Eastern Washington, Interior Alaska, and the Greater Yellowstone area as a fisheries field technician, working on salmonid movement, productivity, trophic relationships, invasion, and management. Lauren recently received her master's in fish, wildlife, and conservation ecology from New Mexico State University, where she studied relationships between brown trout and Rio Grande cutthroat. Last summer, Lauren put a pause on her thesis work to be a Directorate Resource Assistant Fellow for the Alaska Maritime National Wildlife Refuge, and she hopes to begin her conservation career with U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service soon. Welcome to the podcast, Lauren.
Thanks for having me, Nick. I'm happy to be here.
In your email, you include a nice list of conversation starters, and one of those was that your parents met while spawning salmon in the 80s, and I guess you could say that you were destined to work with fish.
Maybe. I think of it more almost like just this odd coincidence. But yeah, I guess somewhere there in the background, there was kind of this underlying presence of salmon in my family, since that's how they met. They were working together at this research laboratory outside of Seattle. And my dad had gotten his degree from Humboldt State, studying fisheries, and my mom had run away from Texas as a young woman and somehow ended up outside of Seattle and got this job to clean aquariums. So she was working for my dad, and that's how they met. The meet cute, I suppose.
Definitely a unique story. I'm sure not too many other people in the field have two parents that met squeezing fish.
Yeah, but then what's interesting, I guess, to me is not too long after that, my dad kind of quit fisheries altogether and decided he wanted to learn how to fly. And so he joined, became a helicopter pilot. Before I was even born, that kind of fishy part of my parents' relationship kind of ceased. But I do remember as a kid seeing all these fisheries textbooks on my dad's bookshelf. And I remember like flipping through those, and we set up aquariums and stuff together. So there, that interest was still there growing up.
Fast forward a few years and you find yourself at Whitman College. Did you plan on studying biology and fisheries, or did you pick the school mostly for the swimming opportunity?
Well, Whitman is a super small, liberal arts college in Eastern Washington, and it's Division III, so you don't get recruited or scholarships for sports there. I chose Whitman because it was just a really good fit of school for me and the right kind of learning atmosphere. And I gravitated towards biology because of an experience I had actually in high school that exposed me to ecology and, I guess you could call it organismal and big biology. And it really opened my eyes to, it was this volunteer experience where I got to help some PhD students down in the Caribbean, snorkeling and counting fish and doing reef surveys. And that just changed my life for sure. It was just so eye-opening to learn that biology was so much more than photosynthesis, not to knock on photosynthesis, but to learn that it was just so much more than the textbook and my high school bio class. And so that's what helped me to know that science was something that I could be a part of, and what pushed me to study biology at Whitman, even though it was really, really hard for me. I was actually almost an art history major just because the science track at Whitman, just was a big challenge.
That was my next question. I saw that you had a minor in art history and visual culture. What's the story with that?
Yeah, that's because I almost majored in it and then changed my mind when I realized that jobs and bio would be way more fun and interesting than jobs and art history. I know that a big part of who I am is getting to spend time and work outside, and you don't really do that in the art history field. So bio, even though I was getting kind of bad grades in it, definitely no, yeah, not like a science whiz, but it just was so much more engaging, stimulating.
And in between some of your semesters, you volunteered in various jobs, and one of those you went up to Homer, Alaska, doing some work with orcas.
Yeah.
I guess when I hear Homer, Alaska, I always think of Alaska, the Last Frontier, and the Kilchers. Did you ever run into any of the Kilchers up there?
Yeah, actually, so that whole connection is my dear, dear friend, Ellie Matkin, is my college roommate at Whitman. We also swam together. And so Eve Kilcher is Ellie's sister, and they grew up together there in Homer. Ellie's dad, Craig Matkin, runs the North Gulf Oceanic Society, which studies orcas in the Prince William Sound. He really got going just after the Exxon Valdez spill, when there was a big push to study the impacts of that spill on the orca pods in Prince William Sound. And so that research continues today. And Craig was in need of an assistant for one of his, research cruises there at the end of the summer before school started again. And so I got to go up to Alaska and see Ellie in her hometown and hang out with her dad on a boat in Prince William Sound. But yeah, so that was a really long answer to, I know Eve and Ivan, and that's Homer for you. Pretty small town.
So what type of work were you doing with the orcas?
Yeah, so Craig was mostly, they track a couple of pods. There's some local pods there, and then also really cool transient pod that was passed through while we were on that cruise. And we did a couple of things. One or two of the whales got radio tagged. They got sampled for genetics. So we, Craig kind of extracted these teeny, it's like the teeniest tissue sample. It's about the size of the head of a brand new pencil, like an eraser on a brand new, and that was for genetics. And then a big part of what I did on the boat was get to have a big fancy camera and take photos of their dorsal fins. As you may know, in orcas, those dorsal fins are like our fingerprints. They're unique among each whale. So it's a really nice way of, and a passive way of identifying individuals.
Well, it certainly sounds like fun, and you gotta hang out with the Kilchers too. But
yeah, it was pretty great.
I didn't expect you to say anything about the Kilchers when I asked that question. I just thought you would say, "Oh yeah, they were there," but I didn't expect you to know them.
I remember. I think it was later. It must have been in 2013 or 2014. Ellie and I were living together in Fairbanks, and I remember somewhere there in the middle of the summer, we went. Did a trip to Homer, and I think it was around Eve's birthday, and we all celebrated together. And Ellie recently got married, so we all saw each other then. And then last summer, while I was in Homer, actually, Ellie has a little cabin on her mom's property that's adjacent to the Kilcher property, and so I'd see Ivan around and stuff. Just small world, you know.
Well, you came back to school, you finished your last year, and after graduating, you worked several temporary or seasonal jobs. Was this a choice, or were you just looking at gaining a variety of experience, or was it more a difficulty of finding a permanent position?
A little bit of everything. It definitely started out as definitely the first couple jobs were wanting exposure to work and to the field. And just to see what kind of opportunities were out there, and really just seizing whatever opportunities were out there. And then as the years went on, I began to understand and realize the challenge that it is to get a full-time benefited job with only your undergraduate degree. Whitman as a liberal arts institution, really trains their students to become academics. And many, many of my cohort have gone on to get their PhDs, postdocs in a wide variety of fields within biology. But I knew after graduating that I needed a break from academics. Like I had mentioned, school was hard for me. I'm no brainiac. So when I got done, I was like, put me to work. I want to get out and work. And so that's what I did. I actually, my first job out of school was from a connection with a swim team mate of mine. Katie Tackman grew up in central Washington in Wenatchee, and she worked for the Forest Service there. And so she knew of a fisheries biologist in that lab that would be looking for seasonal field help. So that was a cool plug-in for me. And that just kicked off my bio-gypsy life there for several years.
So we've heard about the lake trout problem in Yellowstone, but you've worked with a different trouble species there. What can you tell us about bullfrogs in the Yellowstone River?
Yeah, after living in Wenatchee, I ended up moving out to Bozeman, Montana, and that's where I met Adam Sepulveda. He's a research zoologist for the USGS Northern Science Center there, and Adam does a lot of work on a variety of species, but he knows a whole lot about invasive species greater Yellowstone area, and that includes bullfrogs. A lot of folks are surprised to learn that bullfrogs aren't native west of the Mississippi, and yet they have a near worldwide distribution. I think a lot of that distribution got started with frog farms back in the early to mid 1900s when folks were considering frogs as a viable protein source. And then inevitably the bullfrogs escaped and started spreading across the landscape. And that's kind of the case in the Yellowstone River, where they probably either as a pet got released or a farm fell apart or maybe some mixture of the two. And what Adam is seeing is this movement downstream, down the Yellowstone, kind of expansion of bullfrogs through the river. So part of my job one of his seasonal technicians was rowing a raft down the river and performing this sampling protocol to try to find out how far they'd spread.
Definitely a project I guess I don't hear too much about, but I guess I'm not a herpetologist, so it was a neat, I thought it was a neat side story.
Yeah, it is really neat, and there are overlaps and implications for fisheries. They share the same systems. The bullfrog tadpoles are pretty voracious. They mostly eat algae, but they do live and they persist as tadpoles for about 2 years before they metamorphose. And then bullfrogs as adults voracious is just one of the best words to describe them. Generalists, omnivores, they eat anything and everything, including small mammals. That's what we found in our work in Grand Teton National Park, is that a surprising number of these frogs seem to be specializing on voles. There's potential for there to be an ecosystem response to this invasion. I know bullfrogs look pretty cute, but it's important to consider those potential impacts. Yeah, it was a cool project. Definitely not something I ever expected to work on.
Well, my wife would adamantly argue with you that bullfrogs are not cute. So she's disgusted by frogs in general.
Oh, no. I've actually worked on a couple HERP projects for my undergraduate thesis. That was my kind of first exposure to HERPs. And I tell you what, the more you work with them, the more they grow on you. I don't know. I think they're so cool. I mean, it's kind of funny to lump reptiles and amphibians together because they're so totally different. But in either case, they do seem to give people the creepy crawlies. But I don't know. I think they're magnificent.
A few of the other positions that you worked on after your undergraduate degree were helping other graduate students in different labs, and eventually you decided to become the graduate student yourself. What led to that decision? Was it you just kind of seeing, oh, I can do that, or was it just getting kind of tired of doing the seasonal jobs?
It was a little mix of both. I loved getting to work for these graduate students that I worked for. They're all just so bright and so cool, and just it was inspirational. They all are just such hard workers. At the same time, working for them, I learned a great deal about the stresses and rigors of being a grad student. And definitely for the first couple of years there, I was like, oh, this does not appeal to me at all. I definitely had open eyes and ears to what they were going through, and that really intimidated me. I loved, you're kind of, as especially as a field technician, you kind of balance the being like either the brains or the brawn, and field techs are generally the brawn, right? Like we're the hands and bodies out there helping to gather that data. And I really enjoyed just being physical and not having all of the pressures and responsibilities that come with running your own project. However, a couple more years passed by, and I started to realize, as I mentioned earlier, that I wasn't going to get a quote-unquote big girl adult job until I got at least a master's degree. That's just how the world is now. I remember my dad trying to give me pep talks, you know, about when he graduated from Humboldt State back in the 70s and just being able to get a real job right away. And I just kept having to tell him, like, Dad, that's not how the world is anymore. you have to have more education qualified for entry-level full-time jobs. I think that really brought me around to getting my master's degree.
You just recently finished up your master's work at New Mexico State, studying of all things trout in New Mexico. Can you tell us a little bit about your project?
I'd be happy to, because I think it's really cool, and I'm definitely happy to educate and share that there are indeed, well, there's fish in the desert, and there are trout in the desert too, and it's a pretty cool thing. And not only are there trout in the desert, but we actually have a lot of trout down here in New Mexico. We have two native species, the Rio Grande cutthroat trout and the Gila trout. But then in addition to that, we have all the three other non-native species, rainbow trout, brown trout, and brook trout. And especially up north in the mountains, we have them in spades. So my project was looking at the Rio Grande cutthroat trout, which is the southernmost subspecies of cutthroat. And I was working to understand how brown trout were impacting these populations of Rio Grande cutthroat trout. The story of our cutties is really similar to the story of all other cutthroat subspecies throughout the West, which is starting in the early 1900s, and late 1800s, early 1900s, you have westward expansion and settlement. Lots of land use development, and that had habitat implications for our cuts, and that habitat degradation, in addition to there not being that much regulation of the fisheries, and then plus, again, starting in the early 1900s, the introduction of these non-native trout species all kind of spelled disaster for native cutthroat trout populations. And we see these precipitous declines, and in some cases, usurpations, certain subspecies. And so the cutties, Rio Grande cutthroat trout, are no different down here. They experienced all that. And the consensus is that non-native trout are kind of the number one threat to the persistence of Rio Grande cutthroat trout as we work to conserve them into the future. And so there's a lot of different ways you can study fish populations, and a lot of different ways you can study invasion. And the tack that we chose was to look at it through this energetics lens, through a production lens and a trophic lens. So that's what I did. I guess I looked at, I guess you could say, my response variable was secondary production rates of cutthroat trout in the presence and absence of brown trout.
Yeah, I imagine you found that the Rio Grande trout cutthroats perform much better when brown trout were absent.
Absolutely. And just as you naturally kind of honed in on that result, it's not that in and of itself isn't that interesting, right? Like I think managers and anglers have been observing that for years and years now, right? Throughout the West. And it's a common pattern. But there's a couple things that's helpful about at least establish, you know, of getting this data. And one is it at least establishes this baseline, kind of we're showing empirically that this is true. It's not just an anecdotal observation. And then secondly, the second half of my research, because that first piece of information isn't in and of itself all that interesting, is we wanted to understand the mechanism of it. So why are brown trout suppressed the production of cutthroat trout? And for that, that's when we started to dig into the trophic stuff. So what are they eating? What are they eating in the presence and absence of brown trout? Is it different? How does it compare to what's available in the water? What's on the menu for them? And yeah, we chose to look at it from that perspective.
And you also looked at stream temperature and how that affected the Rio Grande, right?
Yes. So as you can imagine, I think one of the first things that comes to mind, and it almost circles right back to why people are surprised that there are trout in the desert, is your first thought is, well, trout are a cold water fish. What are they doing in this hot, arid environment? And so if you look, when you look on a map, I definitely had to, I learned that the Rocky Mountains, the southern tail of the Rocky Mountains, extend down into northern New Mexico. So most of our trout are in these high elevation streams, but because of our southern latitude, those streams can get pretty small and go intermittent. They can get warm. And a previous study of a stream temperature monitoring network of Rio Grande cutthroat trout throughout southern Colorado and northern New Mexico did show that some of these streams get quite warm near that kind of full range. And so that's why we also tied temperature into the study. So beyond the geographic implications for temperature, there's also a body of literature that shows that temperature can impact the relationship between a non-native and native trout species. So we wanted to kind of tie that in. But interestingly, we didn't find a strong temperature effect. My results showed that the presence of brown trout had a bigger impact on these production rates than the temperature did, or an interaction between those two variables. So I don't know. I could go into a whole discussion of why that might be, but that's at least kind of a baseline result. For this study, we didn't find a strong truth.
Earlier in your discussion about your master's work, you mentioned that the cutthroats were found in multiple places throughout New Mexico, and when expansion happened, brown trout were stocked. And do you have any idea of how many streams the Rio Grande cutthroats were in before the brown trout introductions?
Well, I can't give you a precise number, but the concept that is knocked around in the literature quite a bit is that the current populations of Rio Grande cutthroat trout only occupy about 12% of their historic range. And so it's certainly debatable what that historic range is. I think that's kind of based on best guess from, the records that they have available to them and just kind of based on knowledge of, but that's, I can't really give you a number of streams, but right, they have experienced a dramatic range contraction the early 1900s. And let's see, and I do know that currently there are 122, I think, conservation population cutthroat trout. And they're all in these, they're kind of like, I like to think of them like princesses up in a castle. They're kind of isolated in these headwater mountain streams, frequently behind barriers. So they're kind of truly annexed. And that fragmentation means, yeah, you just have these tiny little populations kind of dotted throughout the landscape.
I imagine it's the case, but are there widespread efforts to remove brown trout, or are they kind of a fan favorite among fishermen?
Let's see. So the first known stocking record of brown trout was in 1893. And the last time brown trout were stocked in New Mexico, I think, was 2012, maybe 2011. And so they were stocked pretty regularly for that whole period. And they aren't currently being stocked. However, the New Mexico Department of Game and Fish is kind of managing the best of both worlds. So there's not an active effort to deplete all brown trout populations throughout New Mexico. Definitely not a good use of money, but in targeted and valuable Rio Grande cutthroat trout population, where there are plans for maybe a population restoration effort or some kind of conservation action, that in those very specific instances is when they work on depleting brown trout populations.
So we can tell from some of your answers that you really kind of like this invasion and invasive species work, and you actually took a hiatus from your master's work. You went up to become a Directorate Resource Assistant Fellow for the Alaska Maritime National Wildlife Refuge. And that while there, you kind of did some biosecurity and invasive species work. I guess, how did you get involved with that and just decide to take a break from master's work to go do that?
Right. Well, have you heard of the Directorate Resource Assistantship Program?
I had not heard of it before, but I admit I'm kind of I don't know quite as much as I seem to.
Well, I don't think you should feel bad. You're not alone at all. It's a fairly new program. I think it got started about 7 years ago now. I was a member of the 12th cohort. There's two cohorts every year. And it's this really cool program that, again, because it's so young, it's like a little bit under the radar. And it's a program that's hosted by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, where it's kind of like have you heard of Pathways? Just kind of that general government program. Yeah. So it's like a Pathways program that's tailored specifically for the Fish and Wildlife Service. And the idea is for the service to recruit students, be they undergraduate or graduate, that are interested in careers in conservation. And so it's a competitive thing. You apply and you go through a series of, I don't know, after application, you have to kind of jump through some hoops. And every year, different offices throughout the fish and wildlife offices throughout the country can put together their applications to host a DFP, and it has to have like a specific, it's always an 11-week program, and the DFP has to be accomplishing a specific mission critical project for that office. And so they submit to the DFP saying, we want a DFP to do XYZ. And then the students apply, say, and if they're accepted, they can choose from this menu of potential projects. And then they compete to be the DFP for that project. And it's just like getting hired for a job, like you interview and stuff. And so that was one of the projects that I interviewed for, was working on drafting a biosecurity plan for the Alaska Maritime National Wildlife Refuge. And I guess why it was worth it to me to take a pause thesis to do this is DFPs, after a successful conclusion of their 11-week fellowship and the conclusion of their respective degree, are granted a direct hire authority with the Department of Interior. So the idea is the DFP is a recruiting tool for the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. And again, after my many years of being a bio-gypsy and of being aware of how competitive the job market is for fish and wildlife biologists to get a stable, reliable adult job, even after you get your master's degree, it was being offered that kind of stability was extremely attractive to me. And after sitting down with my advisor and kind of sharing that with her, sharing my goals with her, and then also kind of demonstrating how the DFP is kind of a prestigious thing, it's bringing a lot of kind of honor to our lab. She was sold, and she was totally with me on it and supported me through it. So I really appreciate that.
Yeah, I think your experience there ties into another one of the talking points you provided in an email, was biosecurity and non-native species introductions and how that might be different in a post-COVID world. So what can you tell us about that?
Yeah, I don't know. I've just been thinking about it a lot because I spent all of last summer thinking about biosecurity and draft plan. And I think I remember last summer when folks would ask what I was doing, and I'd say, "Oh, I'm writing a biosecurity plan for the refuge." And I'd get a kind of a spectrum of responses. But one of the main things was like, "Well, what's biosecurity? Like, why are you, where'd that word come from? And why are you throwing it in my face?" And you know, it sounds like super techie, but all it is this idea that, at least in a conservation setting, it's this idea that you are preventing the introduction and spread of a non-native or to a particular place. In this case, it was the Alaska Maritime National Wildlife Refuge, which is primarily comprised of the Aleutian Islands. So islands are super special in that they kind of have this natural barrier, this natural fence around them, the North Pacific and Bering Sea, but they also are extremely susceptible. So once something is there, very quickly decimate the endemic population. And so I don't know. I've just been thinking about biosecurity. I remember, and this is true no matter where you bring up biosecurity, but there's generally a lot of pushback, right? Because you're asking people to take some extra steps to protect a special place. So that might mean cleaning your luggage before traveling to a new place, or taking all your shoes and cleaning off the soles and taking out the footbeds and vacuuming out all the little seeds debris that have down there. And it can feel like a lot to ask for. And witnessing how our world is changing in the face of COVID, it's kind of at least given me some hope that I think it'll be easier for people to wrap their heads around biosecurity for conservation, since now it's a part of our everyday lives to practice biosecurity for our own health and safety and for the greater health and safety of our communities. You know what I mean? Like, I mean, obviously we still see in the news every day that there is pushback from some individual about wearing a mask or wearing gloves, but generally it's become this accepted practice. And so I'm hopeful that with this collective mind shift that it'll also help as we move forward in like conservation angled biosecurity.
Yeah, certainly. Hopefully, I guess in Kansas, an example would be people complain about they can't gather bait beneath a dam and use it above the dam because they might be transporting silver carp. So hopefully, all this stuff going on now makes them realize that all the stuff we've been trying to do in conservation is for a point, and it's not just rules because of rules.
Right. And like, I also think because we've all received now this crash course in epidemiology and virology, that like so many of those concepts are, you know, are sisters to the basic concepts in invasion biology, right? Like, it's all more or less the same thing. It's like the same practices. We're just carrying it through to different systems. So maybe like because people's minds have really been forced to like engage with those ideas, that it'll maybe suddenly make sense for folks. I'm not sure, but I'm hopeful at least.
Well, now the tough part of the interview is over, as we're down to the final five questions. And this is a group of five questions I ask each of the guests that come on the show. And we always start real simple with, what is your favorite fish?
Last summer, while I was in Homer, I went to the farmer's market and I picked up a really fresh rockfish fillet. And that evening, I grilled it for dinner. And I'm like still dreaming about that rockfish. It was that good. And I love how like underrated it is, especially in Alaska, where like salmon and halibut get all the attention. So for right now, I think my throw.
And you've certainly had plenty of experiences throughout your young career, but what is your favorite memory from your career so far?
Oh man, we didn't get to touch on it, but I spent a couple years living in, or I guess a couple of seasons living and working in interior Alaska. And a project I was a part of for both of those years was working on the Susitna, which, if you're not familiar with Alaska, is just one of those huge glacial rivers draining from the Alaska Range. And some of the work we did on the Upper Sioux was, I don't know, life-changing, life-affirming. When I reflect on it, part of what I was doing is I was on a team that was doing a productivity study on that river. And so like every single workday, I was getting to see the world from like all these different vantage points, from like being down on my knees and like scrubbing algae off of a rock to like cradling a huge grayling and flushing its stomach. And then, you know, we'd be jet boating around, and then to get back to camp, we'd be helicoptered back to camp. And so, you know, I was seeing this system from its like smallest cells up to this whole landscape view all in a given workday. And that just like, it's still just like blows my mind. It was really special.
Certainly sounds like a special experience, and I'm sure you've had a handful of those in every one of your stops, but what is your dream job or dream location to work in?
It's hard, like I don't know if there's like an actual job title for what my dream job would be, but I know like pieces of it that would be important to have, and I know in my dream job, it would be maybe like 70% field work, 60 to 70% field work, and then 30 to 40% office based. I know that I would love to like get to spend as much time as possible being in or on the water, like any kind of job that would involve a lot of like swimming or snorkeling, even in cold water. It just like would just bring me a lot of joy. And then for a dream location, maybe somewhere coastal Alaska, or maybe it would be really cool to end up back where I grew up. So maybe in the Skagit Valley or the Olympic Peninsula, somewhere there in the Pacific Northwest. And then I don't know about you, but I would love it if my job was only working 10 months out of here. Like a permanent seasonal position would be super cool.
Definitely times where I feel like,
yeah, like I just think that would be like the perfect amount of time, right? Like you work for those 10 months and then somewhere in there you get 8 weeks off and you're so refreshed and recharged and like ready to work super hard again. That'd be awesome. I wish more jobs were like that.
I took a month of paternity leave back in February and I was ready to get back to work by the end of the month of it. And so I went back to work for 1 week and then COVID-19 happened.
Right.
I had to take another month and a half off, but
it, yeah, puts you right back.
That's a little different. Get to spend more time.
Yeah, you got maybe, but like you, it's different when you don't have the option to like travel somewhere, right? It puts a totally different spin on it, and when it's not by your choice.
So, in all your stops, you've gotten to work on a handful or a couple handfuls of different research projects. If money was not an issue, what is one project that you would like to work on?
Oh, I don't want to choose one project. So actually working for the refuge last summer and getting to visit the Aleutians, which was a part of Alaska I'd been to, it got my brain churning and wheels turning, thinking about, you know, some of the islands in the Aleutians are huge and they have rivers in them. And based on some preliminary research, I think there are some little isolated populations of salmon that might utilize those rivers and spawn there. But I don't think there's been very many like super in-depth studies of those populations. And what's super cool is the Aleutians, right, are this chain that stretch for 1,000 miles and connect, are essentially connecting Russia and Alaska. And Russia has its own populations of salmon and Alaska's populations of salmon. I would love to like do a study where we could look at salmon in the Aleutians and I don't know, like look at their movement or look at their genetics and maybe even somehow study their evolution. I think there's like threads of island biogeography in there that would be super interesting. I don't know. I'm not super articulate, but I definitely want to know more about salmon populations that exist between Alaska and Russia. I think there's a story there.
Sounds like a really interesting project. Any wealthy donors, feel free to contact Lauren.
When I was really on a kick and trying to, I guess when I didn't want to think about my thesis, I would like get online and look at like the National Geographic Explorers grants and stuff and be like, oh man, could I write this up? Could I make this happen? But that's one of the problems with working in the Aleutians is they're so remote that you need just to run the logistics of that trip, not even the science, like just to make logistics happen is incredibly expensive. Probably one of the reasons why there hasn't been a whole lot of study of the fisheries out there.
Our final question is, if there is one point or one principle that you could have programmed into everyone's head, what would it be?
There's like two that definitely come to mind. I guess I'll stick with this, that there are trout in the desert. There's fish in the desert and they're super cool.
Well, Lauren, thank you for coming on the podcast today. It was a pleasure hearing about you and your worldly travels and your bio-gypsying.
Thanks.
If people want to find out more information or get a hold of you, what would be the best way to do that?
Well, you can find me on Twitter. I'm at smelly_waiters because there's a whole lot of Lauren Flynn's in the world. Alternatively, you can reach me at my email. It's my last name, FLYNN, and then my next two initials, L is M as in Marie, at NMSU, NewMexicoStateUniversity.edu.
And if you would like to get a hold of me, you can find me on Twitter at FisheriesPod, on Facebook at Facebook.com/FisheriesPodcast, or old-fashioned email feedback@TheFisheriesPodcast.com. I hope that you enjoyed this episode. You can download past, present, and future episodes on your favorite listening app or stream it from Spotify or TheFisheriesPodcast.com. And don't forget to head over to our Patreon page and support the podcast if you feel inclined. I am Nick Kramer, and thank you for listening to the 77th episode of the Fisheries Podcast. And remember, there are trout in the desert.